The subject I'll be speaking on today is entitled Humanism, and in regards to this, let's turn to Revelation 16 and look at verses 12 through 16. Revelation chapter 16, verses 12 through 16. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirit of devils working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and to the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked, and they see his shame. And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. It seems that recently all of our discussions have come back to this chapter. And for me, it's something that I've been thinking about for the last couple months. And some of this will probably be review for those, or a reiteration for those that are in our Wednesday night class. Regardless, I think it's an interesting topic. And eventually, and this is probably definitely going to be a multi-part talk. And our focus is really on verses 13 and 14 with the three unclean spirits like frogs. Although today I don't think we're going to be mentioning them too much in their historical interpretation, but they are very key to the subject at whole. And what really started me on this is when we think, we were reading this in our class on Eureka that we have on our Thursday night, and when I was preparing for this, I began to think about this, and when we look at fulfilled prophecy, we generally think of events in the past, and I'll use that as a nebulous term, but generally further on the past from our life, or our lifespan. And really, maybe the formation of Israel in 1948 is when we think about fulfilled prophecy, or recently fulfilled prophecy. That's where our mind it goes back to. And that's absolutely a major event. And the goal is not to belittle that or to say that's not important. Absolutely, absolutely was. But generally, all subsequent events that have happened in the past, and that was, you know, well over 50, 60 years ago now. And unfortunately, you know, most of us here today weren't alive to see those things, and those that were are becoming fewer in number. But so when we look at recent history, generally we focus on how they will prepare the way for Christ's return and how they play into the expectation of future events. And once again, that's essential. I don't think there's any problem with that at all, but I don't think we go back and look at how these seemingly small events, or events that maybe, as we talked about in our Sunday school class, that they don't pan out to what we may have expected them to, really play, you know, a part in the bigger role. And for me, that's when we look back and think about the concepts of democracy as represented in the three frog-like spirits, we see so much, really, in our life. When I say our lifetime, I'll talk to my lifetime. So people that are generally my same age, maybe a little bit older, you know, we've seen so much regarding that and the development of that in today's society that I think when we take a step back and look at it, you know, those should be just as, you know, strengthening to our faith as we see these other events, you know, the formation of Israel, the Balfour Declaration, you know, the French Revolution, all these things that are key moments in you know, prophetic fulfillment. You know, I think oftentimes the development of democracy and humanism, which is what we're going to talk about today, is just as should be just as faith building for us. And you know, a lot of these things that we see are not great big, you know, monumental events that happen. You know, some where I look at the fall of communism in Russia as one of those big events. But you know, aside from that, it's a lot of smaller things that we don't necessarily consider. But when we go back and look at them, we see a portfolio of events that have really set the stage for where we need to be. And when we look at, what it says in Revelation 13 or 16, that these spirits were to gather the nations together. And we look back and we can see how that has really happened in our day and age. And once again, hopefully that should give us great strength and help us to hold fast as we wait for the accomplishment of all things for that great day. With that preface, we're not really going to talk about that today. I want to go back and set the groundwork and look at the history behind it. And I think we'll see that this is a developing process. And while these spirits or these mindsets and this philosophy is instrumental in preparing the nations in the last day, in our day and age, it's certainly something that's been around for a long time. This has been a very slow-burning process, as we might say. It's not something that happened all at once. Some of the things we see seem to happen all at once and very quickly. But the concepts of humanism, not so much democracy, but humanism especially, has been around really since the very beginning. And that's what we want to look at today. Look at where it's come from, and then depending on how things go over the next exhortation, maybe two, look at how it's developed in a more modern era, upcoming. So this is a look into the future, the Lord willing. If we have time, and these things don't come to pass, we'll probably look at. We'll have to spend a lot of time looking at more modern history and the French Revolution, and the Enlightenment, as it may be known. But we'll use that in quotation marks, as we're not sure how much illumination came out of that in the truest sense. But then see how that carried on into today's age, and really the outcome of much of that. Today, setting up the stage for what we say for preparing the nations for Christ's return, and really making all the key players ready to join in the battle of Armageddon. So that's where we're eventually going to go. But today we're going to look to the past and see how these things started and where they come into play. Not much, I don't think, from our standpoint, nearly needs to be said about the humanism and democracy as a concept, other than the fact that just everywhere we turn today, in the news, in the media, seemingly, everywhere outside of, hopefully, our ecclesia and our studies, and unfortunately even there, not entirely without being tainted, we see the virtues of democracy and humanism extolled. It's really the doctrine of the day. Everybody is keen on it. And in our society today, we may have to admit that democracy may be the lesser of all evils from a political standpoint. And we do enjoy many of the freedoms it affords us in our nation here, or you shouldn't say in our nation, the nation to which we live, because it's truly not our nation. We can't forget that democracy and humanism, in a bigger part, are absolutely contrary to God's plan and purpose. These ideas don't have any place in the future age. We see them here today, everywhere, but they're short-lived. They're not God's end game, as it were. And to this point, we look at the references we just read in Revelation. How are these spirits described? And when we look at this, we look at the three frog-like spirits. Once again, since it's out of our time frame, we're not going to look at it too much, but just as a note, they've correctly been identified in there as liberty, fraternity, and equality, which were the cries of the French Revolution, really the start of the democratic and humanistic development in the more modern age. The kind of the rebirth of those mindsets came and sprang out of the French Revolution. So when we look at that, how are they described here in the book of Revelation? Well, we see they're mentioned as unclean spirits and the spirits of devils. Things not good. They're not given a good names. But when we look at unclean in Strong's, we see the other meanings of this are impure, when things enter morally lewd, or foul. And this is, if you look at Rotherham's version, just says three impure spirits like as frogs. So when you look at these concepts, you know, the Bible is not vague on God's opinion of these. That they're not good. And when we look at this, we're going to see democracy, and we're going to split really our time between looking at ancient humanism and ancient democracy. But these two forces are a weakening influence in the political realms as a whole. And this, I think, we're going to look at this in probably the meat of our talk today, as experienced or as demonstrated in Nebuchadnezzar's image. Each kingdom, and just this is review, in Nebuchadnezzar's image was represented by a medal. And from the top to the bottom, they progressed through history. So Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold, Medo-Persians, the silver, the Greeks, the brass or copper, and then the Romans, the iron. And then we get to today's age with the feet and the toes, which were mixed with iron and clay, and eventually the image will stand. But when we look at these, each the value of the metal degrades from empire to empire. Now, the interesting part is when you look at the actual empire, the empires themselves grew. They had, more territory. They had more influence and power over people. And yet, from the value, we see it degrading. The Persian Empire, much, much larger than the Babylonian Empire. Yet silver is worth significantly less than gold. And eventually, and this goes down until we get to what we consider the more modern times, where the materials used to represent that time are iron mixed with clay, which was something, would be just about worthless. Because it was just, it's all mixed together, and to get any value out of it, you'd have to separate it out, and a lot of work would be done. So when we get to the feet of the image, from a metallic standpoint, it would be almost worthless. Once again, this isn't by coincidence. God is trying to show us something, and it's our honor to look into those things and try to figure out what they represent. And we can also look throughout, throughout history, we can see that those particular metals have a relationship to the nations or to the empires. But in my focus today is we want to look at how that deals with the strength and the value of the government in God's opinion. But we'll get to that in a minute, because we're going to start today by going even further back than the Babylonian Empire. And we may consider Eve's discourse with the serpent in the Garden of Eden, so literally at the beginning of human events, as quite possibly the first example of humanistic thought. Now, with a lot of what we're going to talk about today, the things can be looked at from different viewpoints and different standpoints, depending on what we're talking about. Today, we're talking about humanism, and democracy, which kind of go hand in glove. And so our thoughts are focusing on it from that direction. And we could also look at, from a different standpoint, we could look at this discourse through, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, and how they appeal to Eve in that regard. Absolutely, that's absolutely correct as well. But for the course of humanism, we see humanistic thought, brought up in this discourse. And it's kind of ironic that the one bringing this up was a serpent who was not human at all. Yet, the rationale that he appeals to Eve is wrought with humanistic ideas. The basic focus of the serpent's thought, let's actually turn back to Genesis. And then here. Let's look at Genesis 3, and really we can just look at verse 4, which is the serpent's discourse with Eve, or what he tells Eve, and Genesis 3, verse 5, "For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then shall your eyes be open, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil." When we look at this, we see the appeal to this would be that by partaking and eating of this fruit, or this item, this tree of knowledge and good of evil, man can supersede God. Man no longer needs God to determine what's right or wrong, and man can be his own arbiter to decide what is right and what is wrong. What's good and evil can be decided on by yourself. And in doing so, that really, in some ways, diminishes or even removes the need for a God, for a supreme being. And so right from the very get-go, we see this idea. No longer is God required to determine what's right or wrong. Now we see that this mindset would continue to display itself after the fall. And unfortunately, we know for us, Adam and Eve both sinned. They ate of the tree of knowledge and good and evil, and as a result, they were expelled from the garden. Mortality became a curse upon man, and we've been suffering from that ever since. But we see this mindset continue, and not really surprising in the next events that are detailed in Genesis, deal with Cain and Abel. And once again, we see more humanistic thought being expressed in Cain. Let's look at Genesis chapter 4 and verses 4 and 5. When we see this, we see Abel and Cain bringing their offerings to God. And we read, "And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had..." Or sorry, we should actually begin in verse 3. "And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and unto his offering. But unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell." So we see Cain, you know, his fault was he brought the wrong thing, but it was more than just an oversight on his part. Cain was determined to define his own form of religion. It wasn't good enough that God said, "You need to bring the animals." Cain said, "I put just as much effort into tilling the ground. Ergo, my offering of the fruit of the ground, the vegetables and the crops, should be just as, you know, valuable as Abel." And we see really, and some of this we have to infer, you know, what he was thinking about. We look at his reaction to his rejection and Abel's acceptance. Very angry, very distraught. And, you know, he's not willing to change his mind, but, you know, he'd prefer to kill his brother than admit that he was wrong. I think we look at that. He was sure that his offering should be acceptable. In fact, he was willing to stake everything on it. And so we see it in Cain. Not a whole lot is told to us about the antediluvian world. We only have a few glimpses into the inside of it, but I think it's interesting, and the insights we do see show this humanistic mindset. The next really example of this would be that of Lamech, which we see later on in the same chapter. So we look in Genesis chapter 4, we see verses 23 and 24. We're introduced to Lamech, and he says, "And Lamech said unto his wives, Ada and Zillah, Hear my voice, ye wives of Lamech, hearken unto my speech, for I have slain a man to my wounding and a young man to my hurt. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold." So there's a couple things we can look at Lamech's speech. One thing, we see that he's married two wives, which neither really here nor there in our discussion, but it is a departure from the setup that God had established with Adam and Eve. Don't really want to open, you know, that can right here, but it's just interesting to note. But the interesting is we look at Lamech and his expression, and Lamech here is determined to define his own form of justice, his own value system as far as exacting revenge. His quote here references Cain's complaint to God when punished. He says, "You know, everyone will slay me," and God says, "Well, you know, I'll put some protection on you that, and, you know, if anyone tries to avenge Cain, you know, it'll be a sevenfold avenging on that individual." But so Lamech says, you know, that's not good enough. You know, if someone hurts me, you know, the revenge or the vengeance on that person will be 70 and sevenfold, you know, much, you know, greater than that which God had prescribed. You know, it was truly, you know, man would be the arbiter of his own justice system, rather than God. When you look really at the end, or through the rest of chapter 4, we see the insight into the development of the antediluvians. And this would be individuals separate from the sons of God, from the line of the faithful, which we see would eventually, you know, really end with Noah. So by his day and age, he was the last of he and his children. But when we look at that, you know, the focus was on items that were pleasing to the individual as opposed to pleasing to God. Their endeavors and their efforts were in pursuits of the flesh. We see, and these things, not necessarily wicked in and of themselves, but I think the point is the focus was that these individuals were dedicating their lives to these things instead of to God. So we see agriculture and the development of those who tend sheep, the development of metallurgy and the developing of metals, to music, and to the development of the arts. You know, we see these individuals that were dedicating their lives to these. We're told that they were men of great renown. And I think by looking at that, we would see that the time and effort they spent in these things led them to be masters of their craft. It was brought to my attention, or I think it was in an earlier class. When you think about this age, you know, today when we think of master craftsmen or artisans, we're talking about someone who has, you know, maybe 30, 40 years of quality time to dedicate to their craft. And in with 30 or 40 years, they can produce, you know, fantastic results. You know, you look at the artwork from some of the Renaissance, you know, some of Michelangelo's sculptures, and especially sculpture, you can see it's fantastic. And that's someone that's, you know, 20, 30 years, you know, dedicated to their craft. Think of someone that would have hundreds of years to determine their craft. You look at the age of before the flood, you know, individuals were living several hundred years. So if they had that time to dedicate to a pursuit, they could truly be masters and come up with, you know, potentially incredible things. The problem with that was, it was just to the exclusion of God. They were saying, I know what I need best. What's best for me is to dedicate my time to this, not, you know, not to God. And the result of this, we see listed in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. When we get to the time of Noah, once again, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 years, seeming in a couple chapters. But when we look at Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5, we are told, and God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thought of his heart was only evil continually. And then if we skip down to verses 12 and 13, and God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupted, and the earth is filled with violence. This is what the mindset, this humanistic thought, had reduced the earth to. And so by the time of Noah, the earth was completely corrupted to the point that really God's option, or what God's decision was to wipe out civilization. There was nothing worth holding on to from that day and age. And destruction was the course. And while the wickedness and the corruption, the words used to describe it, aren't specified, I think if we look at the mentality and the qualities, and we'll use that in finger quotes, the qualities, because they weren't very much, you know, valuable qualities. The individual of this day and age participated, and it's likely that this humanistic thought had a great deal to contribute to it. It was because of this that the earth had become a corrupted and wicked state. The thoughts of man had, you know, for the most part, almost entirely, rejected God. God was not a part of their thoughts. It was the pursuit of what was good for them, what made them happy. And because of that, you know, God decided to, you know, really destroy civilization, and we have the events of the flood. Noah found grace in God's sight, so he and his family were spared. But the rest of humanity was wiped clean by the flood. And when we look through the remainder of divine revelation, it would seem that the flood itself was good in eliminating this mindset and this thought. While we look at the day and age, you know, that would come after it, certainly gross religious apostasy ruled the day. we can look at, you know, the things we see in the Baal worshippers with Egypt. But when we look at what's chosen to be revealed to us through the Scripture, we don't see the same humanistic influence, I think, in the religion as today. Some certain religions elevated certain people within their society to the state of godhood. You can think of the pharaohs in ancient Egypt were regarded as gods. To a lesser extent, I think you look at the Caesars and the Roman and the pagan Roman era. They were elevated, but as a whole, you know, there wasn't a rejection of divine or really, you gotta be careful, as you know, the beliefs in gods as a whole. That they were very central to the belief system of most everybody, you know, in the world. You know, the problems that Israel faced was not a rejection of the concept of a god of whole, but was that there were many gods that they could choose from. And we still see some humanistic mindset in that, as they could worship a god that was pleasing to them, but there was still the focus on, you know, you're praying to a god for whatever reason. So it's interesting that, you know, really throughout the rest of Old Testament history, at least, you know, we see the flood very effective at removing this mindset. Don't want to say that was, you know, it was gone entirely, because we know that, you know, really, that this humanistic mindset, putting one above God, is really one of the key, you know, failures that we all have, I think, and it's something that continues throughout the ages. But as a philosophical system, not really mentioned all that much. So we're going to skip ahead in history to really the Babylonian captivity, and we're going to come back and look at Nebuchadnezzar's image and look at the individual kingdoms there and see how through this time frame we started to see humanism and democracy creep back in. And through it, we see a weakening and a devaluing of political thought as God's opinion. Once again, this is we're focusing, the scope of our words today are based on really political thought more than other things, because once again, we can look at these from many different angles. And part of the brilliance of the Scripture is we see that it's just as applicable, and you know, the symbols have multifaceted relationships to them. So while we're looking at this in this regard, we can still look at it in a different regard and see just as applicable items. But we start with Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian kingdom. And Daniel clearly tells Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 2 that you are this head of gold. So Babylon is represented by gold. And when we look at Nebuchadnezzar as a ruler, he was an absolute monarch. He was an absolute king, had absolute power within his kingdom. This is something that Daniel points out to his grandson, Belteshazzar, right before the kingdom was eliminated. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 5. When you look at Daniel chapter 5, we're going to look at verses 18 and 19. And once again, this is we're saying the baseline here for where we start. The head of gold. Very valuable. Gold, you know, throughout the ages and even today is seen as one of the more precious of metals. So Daniel 5:18 and 19. O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew, and whom he would, he kept alive, and whom he would, he set up, and whom he would, he put down. This was the authority that Nebuchadnezzar executed within his kingdom. He was really the be-all, end-all as far as power goes. He did what he wanted without having to give account to himself, to anyone, or to any group. And we're going to see that this concept slowly erodes through the succeeding kingdoms. So we all know that the Babylonian Empire, actually very quickly or shortly after Daniel gave this rebuke to Belteshazzar, was captured and succeeded by the Medo-Persians. And when we consider Nebuchadnezzar's image, we see that the Medo-Persian Empire was represented by the metal silver. Still valuable, but inferior to gold. Nobody says they'd rather have silver than gold from a value perspective. Now, and when we consider the Persian Empire, we start to see humanistic thought and policy creeping in to the policies of the nation. So like the Babylonian kings, the Persian kings were absolute autocrats. They didn't have to give account to themselves. But unlike the Babylonian kings, they were held accountable to their own laws. And we see this with Darius in the account of Daniel and the lion's den. Let's turn a chapter over in Daniel 6, verses 14 and 15. We know that in the story, King Darius is fooled into making a law that says no one can make any offerings except to the king. And because of Daniel's praying to God, he is arrested as breaking this law. And Darius sees the foolishness that he made and the mistake that he made and would like to save Daniel. But here is the response of the two other presidents that were really behind this entire scheme. So Daniel 6, verses 14 and 15. Then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, "Know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree nor statute which a king established may be changed, even by the king himself." We see a difference. If Nebuchadnezzar had wanted to do something, he would have done it without regard to this. When we look at this, from a humanistic standpoint and from the view of the people, this is probably a better thing, that you have a king that's bound by his own laws. And this is something we're going to see recurring again and again as we go through history, that the power is slowly eroding from the monarch. Once again, kind of bring us back to the overall picture, this power erosion is absolutely incompatible with God's plan and purpose with the earth. Will Christ, as the king, share power with anyone? We say Christ and the saints as a group of manifestation or God manifestation, but will there be anybody to say to Christ as a king, "What are you doing? Why are you doing this?" No, absolutely not. His authority is absolute, given by God. So we see the difference. That's the ideal. Nebuchadnezzar, a perverted version of that. Certainly he was human, he was weak, he sinned, he had gross failings. But we can look at him as an example of the amount of power that God will have in his kingdom. And we see that this degrades. So we see, going back to Persia, we see that the king himself was tied and held to his own laws. And it's interesting that if you look through historical, the history of humanism, that some of the earliest humanistic writings and thoughts come from ancient Persia. There is a writing called the Gathas of Zarathustra, and this was composed between 1000 and 600 BC in ancient Persia, or it says Iran in the article, but that's the Persian Empire. And this would have been just prior, by about 50 years, to the time that the Persian Empire came into being. But succeeded Babylon as the arms of silver of the image. So in this writing, it included teachings that each person is held most morally responsible for their choices made freely in this present life, in the afterlife. Importance was placed on thought, action, responsibility, and the concept of a non-intervening creator. So when you look at this, and this, if you're familiar with political theory of the day and age, many of these same ideas were held by the founding fathers of the United States. But the idea was not that there wasn't a God, but the God really didn't care too much in the affairs of humans. And it was up to the human themselves, the people themselves, to guard or to guide and govern their affairs as they saw fit. And so, once again, we see this humanistic idea raising its head, rearing its head again in society. So, as we continue, the Persians were succeeded by the Greeks. And when we look in the scripture, this is really where divine history starts to be silent. We see the Greeks mentioned in some of Daniel's prophecy, but how they impacted Israel and their life is silent. Really, the era between the Old Testament and the New Testament really corresponds to most of the Greek Empire. But when we look at history, we see that Greece is regarded as really the birthplace of democracy, and really the development of humanistic thought all comes out of ancient Greece. The thoughts in Persia, the development of these ideas happened before the Greek Empire. We think of Athens as a birth of Athenian democracy, as one of the key demonstrations of classical democracy, and that happened well before the Greek Empire. Of course, they were overcome and subdued by Philip of Macedon, who was the father of Alexander the Great, which went on to really found the Greek Empire, as we consider it in regards to Nebuchadnezzar's image. But these mindsets and these thoughts had already seeped into Greek, and really the Hellenistic mindset that would have been in place during this time. So much of, when we look at humanistic and democratic writing, a lot of the actual writings of the era are lost through subsequent wars and natural disasters or whatever. The actual writings are lost, but we see references, or scholars see references to them in other writings. Some of these philosophies that are extant and are recorded today, definite humanistic thought. The first one, I think, is probably the most important in that, in which one of these influential philosophers of the day stated that man is a measure of all things. So when you're measuring not literally the measure, but it's to held accountable. Man is a statue. That's the key, measuring base for everything that's done. How does it relate to man? We also see human-centric approaches and not the promise of an afterlife are the key to human welfare. To make humans happy and have the best possible life, we have to focus on what makes it good for us and not really worry about what's happening in the afterlife. We see concepts that nature is to be studied as separate from the supernatural realm. From the scientists today, we might say, well, yeah, that's probably pretty good. But when we look at the philosophy of the day and age, this is really, saying akin to probably modern-day evolution as we see it today, that there was a full separation between the real world, the natural world, as they would say it, and the supernatural, or the divine realm. There was no interaction. So we have to look at, I think in some ways, the essence of what's being said. And then there's others that were influential that question the gods, just in general, whether they existed and what their purpose was, and at best relegated the divine concepts of the world to that of universal unity, some of these bigger, more nebulous concepts. But in regards to the day-to-day life and man's affairs, some of these philosophers questioned whether there even were gods. Once again, we know that the concept of gods and religion was grossly apostate and nowhere close to the true form of worship. But what we're seeing here is not really a rejection of their gods, but the rejection of the concept of God in general and the concept of the divine, which up until this point was, and even after, because we see that it wasn't a wholesale rejection really to really our day and age. But we see these concepts starting to be questioned and starting to be diminished in importance. And this was from the Greek Empire. So for that, that's a humanistic thought. And as we can continue, we see the Grecian development of democracy, which once again, when you read any history, that's one of the main things that's stressed. That Greek, ancient Greece was the birthplace of democracy. That's what's being stressed. Not surprising from our culture, that's what's focused on. But we look at it. So the democracy that the Greeks established were, and this was in Athens in particular, was interesting. So random citizens. So it was limited to the citizens of the city state. So Athens in this point or whomever picked this. But random ordinary citizens were selected to fill existing government, administrative, and judicial offices. So instead of having a hereditary monarch or a king, these responsibilities were given or appointed to selected citizens. In Athens, there was a legislative assembly consisting of all citizens who were allowed to speak and vote, and which generally set the laws of the city-state, so the government of Athens. Now, as we mentioned, this was focused on Athens, who was really, you know, the birth part, considered the birthplace of democracy. And many of these concepts were not included in the Grecian Empire. So when we think, you know, the Empire of Alexander the Great, he wasn't an elected official. People, you know, the people of Greece didn't say, "Alexander, we think you're great. You have our vote of confidence." No, he was a king who conquered and was a monarch. But when we look at the administration of his empire, we see these concepts in there, and really a greater development than was even in the Persian Empire, which held the king accountable to his own laws. Under Greek, and this is Macedonian government, which Philip of Macedon was his father. Alexander was a Macedonian, and so this was the key for their government. Was this item or this body called the Synedrion, and this body prepared and proposed decisions which an assembly would discuss and vote. The Synedrion was composed of high-standing officials or high-standing individuals from the empire. Many of them were nobles that were born. Some were voted on and elected by the king himself. But the fact is that these were non-royal individuals that were gathered to make these decisions. The assembly that I mentioned was actually composed of the citizen soldiers of the realm. So they were citizens, but they're also the army. So they had a role to play. So this Synedrion, designated kings and regents and that of high administrators. That was part of their responsibility. So if a new king came into place, it would be their responsibility to really ratify him, or if there was any sub-rulers, it would be their job to say this was okay. They had the ability to declare war on neighboring countries or their enemies. It was also the first and final authority for all judicial cases which did not involve capital punishment. So we start to see that the justice system is no longer at the behest of a king, although I'm sure that the king could step in if he wanted to. But day-to-day judgments were given to the hands of these officials. So we see that this core body acted as really the think tank for the assembly. It would be the assembly technically voted on many of the issues that this group came up with, but oftentimes it was just a matter of formality. The assembly itself, we said, was gathered of the kingdom's citizen soldiers, so those who were citizens and also part of the army. And it gathered twice a year. And once again, you know, this group set kings. It consulted in matters of foreign policy, which included declarations of war and treaties, and really for the appointment of high state officials. So that, once again, these individuals would be key in performing these duties. It voted on honors to be distributed throughout the system, so who was going to be recognized for distinguished service to the empire would come from this group. And it also was in charge of sending emissaries to foreign countries. So these tasks, really, we're talking about inter-empire politics, were, you know, in large part due to this assembly of soldiers. And so when we look at this, this was in the background of the Greek Empire. Many of the overall policies, you know, like the decision to go and fight in India, to fight against the Persians, you know, that would be the king's ambition. And oftentimes, you know, almost, you know, all the time, you know, the people would be behind the king, behind that. But this was going on behind the scenes during the Greek Empire. We see the power degrading even further. And the Greek Empire, as we go down history, was succeeded by the Roman Empire. And when we look at Roman politics, much of what was started in Greece was embodied and really embellished and continued through the Roman Republic, which happened once again by the time we get back to divine recorded history in the Gospels and in the Epistles. the Roman Republic had come and gone. It was under the Roman Empire. Yet much of the traditions of the Roman Republic still continued into the empire. So the Roman Republic was governed from Rome by the Senate and was headed by two consuls who were elected annually by citizens, and these consuls really advised were advised by the Senate. So under the Roman Republic, the leaders were elected by the citizens of Rome. So no longer do you have a king, you have two elected officials that are advised by a group of elected senators. So the Senate and the Senate here was composed of appointed magistrates. And the Roman government was heavily influenced by... take it back here, look at my notes. So the government was heavily influenced by the struggle between the patricians, which were the existing higher and the existing nobility and Rome's traditional aristocracy, and the plebeians, who were the normal common citizens of the day. So under the Roman Republic, there was continual headbutting between these two groups in regards to the way the country should be run. I think we see, this is a concept we see throughout democracies as a whole. You see those, we heard about the 99% and the 1%, very recently. Kind of the same idea here. What's interesting is that throughout the history of the Republic, the laws that gave this, 1% class, as we might use in today's term, or the aristocracy, exclusive rights to high offices and other, special events, were gradually weakened or repealed as the plebeians, the common citizens, gained more power. So throughout the history of the Republic, the power of the aristocracy decreased, and was replaced by power to the common, everyday citizens. And it was noted here, in speaking of the Roman Republic, that many of Rome's legal and legislative structures can be observed throughout Europe and much of the world today. So much of what happened and started in the Roman Republic carried on even to today. And I think it's mainly the same, similar, in concept. We look at the Ten Commandments today, and while they're not particularly extolled today, we see the concepts of that in many of the laws passed today. We see the same, the fundamentals passed on. So this, from a democratic standpoint, the Roman Republic is really the prototype for a lot of what we see today. Once again, the Republic was succeeded by the Roman Empire. And while the consuls as the head of the nation were eliminated and replaced by an emperor, once again, an autocrat, someone who did as they pleased, this history and traditions were not eliminated at that time. So while the emperor contained the main power, there was still a considerable amount of power that remained within the Senate, which remained comprised of elected officials. And it says, reading from some comments, it says, although the Senate could do little short of assassination or open rebellion to contravene the will of the emperor, it retained its symbolic political centrality during this time frame. So it maintained its incorporation, and it still retained some power. It had really power over the masses. And if you look through the history of the Roman Empire, especially later on, we see there was quite a bit of turnover sparked on by assassination, by civil unrest, by the people more than other political powers. The Senate also legitimized an emperor's rule. So when the time that a new emperor came, either by death of the previous one and to appoint a successor, or by assassination and the new emperor came up, it would be the Senate that legitimized that emperor's position. And the senators themselves were experienced diplomats and generals, and so they were leveraged by the emperors in the day-to-day operations and affairs of the country. So they still held a considerable amount of power. And this really, these democratic institutions really continued, really up until the point when Rome moved from being a secular power to becoming a religious power. And it's really when we see that change that a lot of the democratic institutions cease to exist. And that'll be a subject for a different time. But it's interesting that once Rome became a primarily religious institution, that giving power to the people was no longer a concept that, you know, the papal system liked to promote. You know, the power resided within the Pope and the cardinals, within a core group, not with the people. So stopping from our history lesson here, the thing we have to, I think I want to stress on this is more than just history. It is a lot of history, and we've gone back and looked at political theory throughout the ages, but it's more important than just, you know, being able to answer questions correctly on a history exam or a government exam. The three frog-like spirits are essential to the plan and purpose of God. And once again, you know, these are correctly identified as liberty, fraternity, equality, the cries of the French Revolution, which really opened the door to democracy in Europe and has really formed the world as we see it today, or the modern world. There's still, if you look at maps from the UN or whatever, you see there's still many countries that have, you know, no democracy or whatever, but quite frankly, you know, it's usually the third, what we consider third world nations, as far as movers and shakers, as we say, in the world's affairs. You know, not too worried about that, other than for that of, you know, humanitarian aid. You know, I don't think we're, as a most part, worried about what, you know, the Sudan is going to do in you know, government politics and how that's going to affect, you know, the world at large. But when we look at the main players in government or in political affairs in the world, the majority of them are either democratic or have some form of democratic ties, you know, to it. So once again, essential. These concepts are essential to what God has planned for the world today. That's what we're supposed to be engaged in, to looking into, waiting for Christ to come. We're looking into these things, and as such, you know, it's important to see where they came from and how they're operating today. And you know, it's also important because we're surrounded by them today. You know, we can't go out and really do anything, you know, outside of these doors without being bombarded by, you know, humanistic or democratic propaganda. You know, that's just the way it is. And, you know, oftentimes these are used to rouse patriotic feelings, especially we just had, the anniversary of the 9/11, you know, bombings. We see a lot of, you know, commercials or news broadcasts, you know, focusing on that. And the purpose there is to rouse patriotic feelings amongst its citizens. And while we do thank God for the freedoms we're given, the ability to worship as we please, the freedom to be able to, you know, read our scriptures without having to be worried about, you know, being arrested or you know, worse things, you know, being put to death for our beliefs, we can't forget that we are strangers and pilgrims within this world. We think of, you know, Hebrews 11, verse 12, you know, mentioning Abraham, but also all those that died in faith. You know, they recognized that they were strangers and pilgrims. That's really where we should be. We can't get caught up in this mindset, because this isn't the world we're looking for. As we said before, these are unclean spirits. These are not things that are pleasing to God. If we get tied up in them, if we get bound up in them, we're going to find ourselves, as Christ said, you know, with a conflict of interest. You know, we can't love both, you know, we can't serve both God and mammon. So we have to be on guard against these. In addition to this, let's take a look at Zechariah chapter 9. We just read this and studied this not too long ago in our Wednesday night class, but I do think that it's worth repeating and reviewing in regards to this. So Zechariah chapter 9, verses 12 through 15. Zechariah's message is, "Turn you to the stronghold, ye prisoners of hope. Even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee. When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy son, O Greece, and made thee as the sword of a mighty man. And the Lord shall be seen over them, and his arrow shall go forth as the lightning, and the Lord God shall blow the trumpet, and shall go with the whirlwinds of the south. And the Lord of hosts shall defend them, and they shall devour and subdue with sling stones, and they shall drink and make noise as through wine, and they shall be filled like bulls and as the corners of the altar. The important part here is in verse 13, where God says that he would raise up thy sons, O Zion. And, you know, truly we hope to be, you know, the sons of Zion, the spiritual Israel, against thy sons, O Greece. So in this reference, we see that Greece is represented as the enemy of God. And once again, I don't think it's any coincidence that Greece, as a nation, as a kingdom, is seen as a birthplace of really modern humanistic and democratic thought. So in the scripture, we see that, you know, there is an antagonism that is between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of man, the kingdom of democracy and humanism. When we look back at history, we see the last time humanism, and this is, once again, my inference, that humanism gained, you know, popular and universal acclaim, the outcome was the destruction of the world in which all but eight souls perished. Noah and his family were the only one to come out from the antediluvian world, and that's because they rejected, or at least Noah did, rejected that mindset. He had put his faith in God. And the core values of humanism are diametrically opposed to the ideas of the true gospel. And this, I want to close with this in manner. And it's a discussion, and it's something we brought up in Wednesday night class last week. Where when we talk about humanism, the greatest good in humanism is really yourself. We might generalize that to humanity as a whole. But generally, as long as you want to do something and it doesn't impact others, that's fine. That's good. And that goes directly against God's teaching. You know, we are taught that, you know, we are not to consider ourselves. And in fact, let's look at Luke chapter 14 and verse 26. In Luke 14, verse 26, we read, and this is Christ speaking, says, if any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And we had discussed, when you look at hate, it's translated also, if you look in Matthew, a very similar verse, in Matthew 10:31, it's translated as love less. So if we place our life and our happiness and our ambitions above that of God's, which really is the tenet of humanism, that your own happiness and you are your greatest good, then we cannot serve God. We are not acceptable servants to God. We cannot and we are not following him. So this is, once again, this is what we need to keep in mind. This is what we need to believe. Because, and we have to have faith in these verses and believe it, because that flies in the face of everything that the world is teaching. As soon as we open those doors and go out, we're receiving a diametrically opposed message. And we have to be strong enough to combat against it, to have that shield of faith to quench those fiery darts that are coming our way. And once again, this is foundational work. But I think once we go back and we look at more modern day era, you know, this should help increase our faith. We can see that God's plan is being worked out, and it's leading to the Battle of Armageddon. And what the outcome of the Battle of Armageddon is, the destruction of these systems. It's the beginning of that. It'll be a long process. As a matter of fact, it'll take 1,000 years before it's completely completed. But the outcome of that will be the destruction of these things. And so we have to have faith and make sure that we are aligned on the right side, because if we're not, you know, it's death. So in closing, let's take a look at the message in Revelation 16 that's left for us. We see in verses 13 and 14 that these spirits go forth, these unclean spirits, throughout all the earth. And there's a message of encouragement. There's a message of exhortation left for us in these verses in verse 15, where we read, behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. So when we see these things, and we need to keep in mind that Christ's return is coming. He's coming as a thief, not to us. Hopefully not to us. It shouldn't be a thief to us, but a thief to the world at large. You know, he's coming, and we need to keep our garments. We need to keep what we can, lest we are caught unawares. And so may we each be ever vigilant and watching and waiting for the return of Christ. Now with this, we'll continue into our memorial service where we remember our life and sacrifice of our Lord and Master. And we'll do so with the singing of the memorial hymn, which is hymn 110. The true Messiah now appears, the types are all withdrawn. So fly the shadows and the stars before the rising dawn. Hymn 110. The Orlando Ecclesia's basis of fellowship is exclusively the unamended statement of faith. We welcome those who believe and adhere to those doctrines and commandments stated therein. A few brief words before we partake of the memorial service. We await the return of our Lord and Master, and it's His life that we consider today. And in James chapter 2, verse 20, we read, "But wilt thou know, O vain man, that faith without works is dead?" And the purpose of our exhortation, the purpose really of the memorial service, is to build our faith so that we may faithfully hold fast until the return of Christ. And we look at Christ as an example of faith and works perfected. When we reflect on the life of Jesus, we can see the total fulfillment of James's ideal here, that faith without works is dead. And really, we don't consider in Jesus' life the negative aspect of it, but we see that when faith is perfected through works, we find salvation. And that's the example that Jesus shows us. And all four accounts agree to this and demonstrate the complete man of faith that Jesus was, the complete faith He placed in His Father, and how that through that faith He was able to perform the works that He did. And this is what we see in many ways in the emblems before us, or in this particular way. And when we look at the symbol of the bread, I think we see an example of the faith of Christ. From His earliest years, Jesus set about to be about His Father's business. And through His study and devotion, Jesus developed a conviction in God's law and testimony that were unwavering. No matter the situation He was in, He knew, and I have that emphasized, he knew. He just didn't think it, but He was convinced and absolutely convinced that God would provide what was necessary. And because of this, He was willing and He was able to overcome every obstacle He faced. His life was dedicated to the principle that thy will, not mine, be done. When dealing with the people, Jesus often recognized the faith, or lack thereof, of the individual that had come to Him. We read of the rebukes, O ye of little faith. We also read the commendations, go thy way, thy faith has made you whole. And indeed, as our greatest example, Jesus' faith perfected Him. For though He led a sinless life, He didn't fall once to personal transgression. And as the unleavened bread before us, we see the symbol is kept from the corrupting influence of yeast. We see His faith exhibited in this unleavened bread. His faith was not tainted with the leaven of humanistic thought or faith in Himself, but it was kept from that. And complementing the bread is a symbol of the wine, which Jesus says is a symbol of the poured out blood for the establishment of the new covenant. And as such, I think we see in this the symbol of the works Jesus did, His execution on the faith He had. Throughout His ministry, Jesus' words and deeds marked Him as the beloved Son in whom the Father was well pleased. Of Jesus, it is recorded that He spake, what he heard from his father. He claims that in John 14, verse 24. And because of this, it was said of Jesus, never man spake like this man, from John 7, 46. And his actions, John writes, if I had not done among them the works which none man or no other man did, so through his works he portrayed the Father. And later John wrote, if every work which Jesus did could be written, every one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that should be written. Hence, and because of this, we see the numerous works that Jesus performed. He was always about his Father's business, as that was his endeavor. So he executed upon this. But from his body of works, we remember a singular incident right now, and the act that confirmed the rest, and because of that, is the focal point of importance, and that was his willing submission to the death on the crucifixion stake. Through this action, Jesus became the antitypical sacrifice of which all offered before pointed to, and which all in the future would memorialize. Through this action, he secured eternal life for himself by complete obedience and fulfilling the Father's will, and gave us an example of a life that we could follow. When we consider Jesus' work as a whole, truly his works were made perfect through his faith, and his faith made perfect through his works. So as we consider the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus today, may his faith and works be remembered and refresh our spirit, and through that we continue to try to improve our faith and our works as we await his return. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 26 and read the account of the memorial service beginning at verse 26. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. And he took the cup and gave thanks and gave it to them, saying, drink ye all of it. For this is my body, or this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for the remission of sins. But I say unto you, I will not drink henceforth of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Now we'll stand and we'll call on Brother Sid Strickland to give thanksgiving for the bread.
And eternal Yahweh,
and we'll call on Brother Mac Brierley to offer thanksgiving for the cup of wine. We will conclude our service this morning with the singing of hymn 39. Let all the world rejoice, the mighty Yahweh reigns. The thunders are his voice, our life his will ordains. The glories of his holy names, the lightning's floods and hail proclaim. And after singing, we'll call on Brother Dave Pirtle to close our meeting with a word of prayer.